Okay, it's November 7th. We're starting a new series today. I apologize for that. I didn't realize that the pocket size was being ordered when I ordered them. I didn't see it. I'm sorry, but the letters are very big. That's why. Okay. I was not aware of this. I thought it was about 10 years. Mark over here tells me that 15 years ago he took a class from me on this book. Somewhere in the archives, I have it recorded. But actually, I really just did. I'll just come in here and press the button every day. So it was 10 years. Anyway. In any case, it's a new start for me. Not having learned it in this long, it's a new start for me. I did it twice. And the introduction, which begins on page 21, is a very interesting one. It's important to know, just not to get caught up, because if you look into the table of contents, you'll see that the book is a very, very fascinating book, and it's really become a main source of Jewish outlook on many esoteric and many very basic principles of Jewish Torah thought. But the introduction itself does not address the subject matter of the book. Okay, the introduction itself only addresses how he's going, the methodology needed to learn the material that he's going to use to teach in the book. Okay, again, the material that we're going to study, you'll find in the introduction. That's not what is spoken about in the introduction. We're only going to speak about over here the methodology that we're going to use in the book itself. And he starts off by saying as follows. When one knows a number of things and understands how they are categorized and systematically interrelated, then he has a great advantage over one who has the same knowledge without such distinction. When I read this paragraph today, the first thing that came to mind, and eventually we'll speak about today, a number of things that came to mind for me, but the first thing that came to mind for me is that about 140, 150 years ago, in the yeshivas in Lithuania, there was the mother of all yeshivas, as it was called. It was called Volozhin. It was a small city in it was really one street in Lithuania, and there was a great yeshiva. And at its height, maybe 400 students, maybe 400 students studied in Volozhin. But it was the elite of the elite. And even when when they started with the anti-Torah ways of thinking and, you know, the progression that people thought that they had, many, many of the great minds that took part in the Haskalah actually came from Volozhin. And then sort of they went off. But they had the brains that came from Volozhin. They had many, many great Rosh Yeshivas, heads of the yeshiva in Volozhin, and eventually, probably the most famous of the Rosh Yeshiva that were the heads of the yeshiva in Volozhin were the Netziv, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, and also, I believe, his grandson-in-law, I think, Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik. Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik was the Rav in Brisk, which was the second largest city, I think, Jewish city in Lithuania. I think it was after Vilna. It was the second largest city. Reb Chaim, and he was known as Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, and he was not the head. His father, Reb Yoshe Ben Soloveitchik, was really the head of the dynasty, of the Soloveitchik dynasty, which very much continues to today. But Reb Chaim Soloveitchik was this incredibly brilliant mind. And what he did was, in a very interesting way, this did not apply as much to the Hasidic world, but in the Lithuanian yeshiva world, he introduced a new way of study, a new way of analysis. And that new way of analysis so revitalized Talmudic study and in-depth study that so racked the brains And I'm really not adept at explaining to you the depth of what it really was, although it was part of my yeshiva training, probably from the age of 17 and onwards. But basically, what Reb Chaim tried to teach us to do, and there are books that he wrote that are based on this method of analysis, was to try to take an item, to see the distinctions between the different items that you were talking about, and then to be able to determine different consequences and results and laws that would come about as a result of the distinction in the item itself. The most famous one would be that you see a contradiction between two different things, and you would say, well, one is talking about the gavra, one time you're talking about the person and his relationship to the item, and one time you're talking about the heftza, you're talking about the item itself. I don't have the mind today to be able to go into details, to give you examples of it. But being able to distinguish between two different things at its root, two different things, allows you to open up a whole new avenue of looking at the big picture and see the distinctions that follow from the distinctions that come out of its root. In its essence, we would call it Havdalah. Now, Havdalah, we just say separate, right? But it's much more than just separate. It's to distinguish between items. When we were studying the book a number of years ago, Bilvavi Mishkan Evna, in my heart, I build a sanctuary. We had a whole unit where it says, "Ein Deya." If you don't have intelligence, if you don't have real knowledge, if you don't have real wisdom, Havdalah Minayin, how are you able to distinguish between things? But we're going to, just for the purpose of this introduction here, we're going to flip that around. That statement comes from the Jerusalem Talmud. But we're going to flip that around. And we're going to say, "Ein Havdalah." If you don't have the ability to distinguish between things, Deya Minayin, where does real intelligence come from? Because as he's going to say here in the introduction, that when everything is a mishmash, when everything is put together, then everything is the same, then there's nothing really to learn from anything, because you can't distinguish between the various items. And you can't say what's unique about this, what's special about this. If everybody in the room is the same, then how do you use everybody's qualities to the benefit of humanity? If everybody's the same, so then nobody has areas where they're better than others in certain areas, it's going to put a stop to the progress of humanity. You have to be able to distinguish between people. You have to be able to distinguish between things, between ideas, and between talents. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later on. But that's this first paragraph that we have over here, this first thing, is the root of the entire book. You know, when people ask questions about Judaism that they don't understand, they're legitimate questions. Questions are legitimate questions. If they're asked honestly, they're legitimate questions. But oftentimes they're asked because everything is the same, and therefore if everything is the same, this doesn't make sense, and this doesn't make sense. It doesn't fit. It's not the same. It doesn't fit. But if we understand that everything has its place, and everything has its reason, and everything, then you just have to figure out, oh, which category does that fall into? Where in the hierarchy does it fall? Where does it belong? Once I can determine that, and I can distinguish that, then everything can turn into magnificent painting. If I take 10 different colors, if I'm an artist, and I take 10 different colors, and I put them all on the same palette, and I mix them all together, and then I make a painting, I don't have much. But if I have 10 different places, and I know where on the canvas each one belongs, then I can have a magnificent, magnificent piece of art. And that's the universe. And that's the Torah as well. We have to know where everything falls in. When you pluck something out of context in Judaism, and you ask a question about it, or about God, or about basically about anything in the world, and it doesn't make sense to you, you've heard me say many times, when my kids come home and they study something, and they say, "But it doesn't make sense." I said, if it's in the Torah, it makes sense. You can say it doesn't make sense to me, or I don't understand it. Yes, because you don't get the whole picture. Now we have to try and figure it out. If God said it, it makes sense. To me, it doesn't make sense, because I don't see all the parts. But if the more of the parts that we see, and the more distinction we're able to make, the more answers we have, and the more beautiful the picture becomes. And that's the methodology that he's going to use in the book, that he's going to pick things apart and show you where everything belongs in the big picture. Okay, let's continue. It is very much like the difference between looking at a well-arranged garden planted in rows and patterns and seeing a wild thicket or forest growing in confusion. Right? You see a wild thicket or forest growing in confusion. It's a mishmash. You see beautiful plants. You see beautiful flowers. You see edibles. You see things that are only meant not to be eaten, but to be seen. Then everything has its place. If it's all together, then it's very, very difficult to distinguish and determine what each thing is. When an individual is confronted by many details and does not know how they relate to one another or their true place in a general system, then his inquisitive intellect is given nothing more than a difficult, unsatisfying burden. How do I take this apart? How do I distinguish what's what? How do I make heads and tails out of anything? He may struggle with it, but he will tire and grow weary long before he attains any gratification. Each detail will arouse his curiosity, but not having access to the concept as a whole, he'll remain frustrated. Again, remember, this is only the introduction, but it's setting the tone where we're going with the book. If one wishes to understand something, it is therefore very important that he be aware of other things associated with it, as well as its place amongst them. Without this, one's longing for truth will be frustrated, and he will be pained by his unsatisfied desire. Just look, even take something so simple as a computer and a keyboard. When you don't understand how things interrelate with one another, or how one thing works together with another thing, you can go crazy trying to figure it out. I don't consider myself computer literate. I know how to use a computer, but I'm convinced that as much as I use it, I'm making up a number. 10, 15% of the power of what it could really do for me, 5%, I don't know, right? Because I don't understand really where everything belongs and how everything works and what's the purpose of this and what's the purpose of that and how is this supposed to help me. The more I learn and the more I understand, the more satisfaction I get out of it and the better I can understand it. It's like that with all kinds of knowledge as well. So I'd like to quote to you just from the Chumash a very interesting idea. When this comes up, it shows up different places in the Torah, but I believe it's at the end of, it's in Parsha Shmini. This is after the death of Nadav and Avihu, the two older sons of Aaron, during the dedication of the tabernacle of the Mishkan, and God gives a commandment to Aaron, and he says, do not drink intoxicating wine, Yayin v'sheicha al teisht, you and your sons with you when you come into the tent of meeting. When you enter the holy temple, when you enter the Beis HaMikdash, you're not allowed to drink wine. The Kohen is not allowed to do his service in the temple once they've drunk wine, even if they're not intoxicated. They don't drink wine beforehand. Which, by the way, if, let's say in Eretz Yisrael, they do the duchim, the Kohen's blessings that the Kohanim do, right? So outside of Eretz Yisrael, in most places, not all over, we only do it on Yontif. In Eretz Yisrael, they do it every day. So, you know, some people, after Torah reading on Shabbos, they like to go into the kitchen, or they like to go, somebody like to have a little schnapps, they make a little kiddush, then they have a little herring. I don't know if they do it here, but you know, it's like a thing to do. Once a Kohen does that, so let's say this was an Eretz Yisrael, he wouldn't be allowed to go up to Duchen during Musaf, based on this verse. You're not allowed to drink wine or intoxicating things before the Kohen does his service. Which is why in Simchas Torah, when after Shachris we do the dancing with the Sefer Torah and everything, and we make Kiddush and people drink wine, we do the Duchening, the Kohen blessing, by Shachris, not by Musaf. Because most people, or many people, will have drunk wine or something during the Kiddush, and therefore they wouldn't be allowed to duchen during Musaf. So that's where that comes from. But this is a prohibition of going into the temple intoxicated or drinking wine, you know, before they do the service. This is an eternal decree for your generations. And then it's interesting. The Torah says, in order to distinguish between the sacred and the profane, and between the tameh, the contaminated, and the pure. The Torah writes that. There's a mitzvah here in the Torah. There's a mitzvah of Havdalah. I don't even want to go into explaining now why that's related in that area. Perhaps because drinking oftentimes clouds the ability to be able to distinguish. Right? So it's mentioned right there. What? Maybe you're constantly in that state, you know?
What did they make way back when? Did they make kiddush like we do now? Way back when with the temple, with the other?
They certainly drank wine, that's for sure.
But if it's for sacramental
even if you're drinking for holy purposes, a kohen is not allowed to go in after having drunk, even if it's for the holiest of purposes. A kohen is not allowed to do his service. He has to do the service first, and then he can drink. Then he can drink wine. To my knowledge, anyway, there is no drinking of wine in the Beis Hamikdash as part of the sacramental or ritual reasons.
Not doing that, making kiddush on Shabbat.
No, that wouldn't be a reason. No. It wouldn't be a reason. Then you have again over here at the end of the very same parsha, the Torah speaks about. It happens to be that there's the mitzvahs of kosher are given for the first time earlier in this parsha, and then it says as follows. For I am Hashem your God, you shall. This is a different part of the Torah portion. This has nothing to do with the Kohanim per se going into the temple. You shall sanctify yourselves and you will be holy, for I am holy, and you shall not contaminate your souls through any teeming thing that creeps on the earth. Right? So somebody says, I don't feel a difference when I eat shrimp or when I eat creepy, crawly things. Yeah, you're contaminating your soul. You're hurting your soul. You're making your soul tummy. For I am Hashem, so if you had a Geiger counter that was able to detect the soul, when you eat non-kosher food, the Geiger counter would start making lots of noise. Okay? For I am Hashem who elevates you from the land of Egypt to be a God unto you. You shall be holy, for I am holy. This is the law of the animal. As I said, the laws of kashrus came just before this. The bird, every living creature that swarms in the water, and for every creature that teems on the ground. To distinguish between the contaminated and the pure, and between the creature that may be eaten and the creature that may not be eaten. So twice in this parsha, the Torah speaks about the concept of Havdalah. Now when you hear Havdalah, you say, I thought Havdalah is what we do on Saturday night. Yes, it is. That's the distinction between the sacred and the mundane, between Shabbos and the week. Right? That's one form of Havdalah. So, on this thing that I just read over here, where the Torah speaks about being able to distinguish between the contaminated and the pure, and between that which is eaten and which is not eaten, the Rambam, Maimonides, says as follows. He says, mitzvahs, this is so fascinating, mitzvahs aseh, it's one of the positive commandments in the Torah, leida hasimonim, to know the signs that distinguish between a kosher animal, a domesticated animal, and a chaya, which is a wild animal, and birds, and fish, and grasshoppers, that it's permitted to eat, and between those that it's not permitted to eat. How do you know? Because the Torah says, v'hivdal tem, and you shall distinguish between the pure and the contaminated, and between those that are eaten and those that are not eaten. Right? So the Rambam says it's a mitzvah to know the difference. Now, that's an interesting thing. Because what are the signs of a kosher animal? Let's leave birds. Because for birds, I don't know the signs. We only eat birds based on a tradition that we have. If we have from our parents and their parents and their parents that a certain bird is kosher, we eat those birds. We're not familiar with the signs for kosher birds. Right?
Well, we're told what birds not to eat.
We're told, but we don't know that. Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. But also in the Torah, we don't know the proper translation for all of the birds. Yeah. Therefore, there might be some on the list that we don't know what they are, and therefore, unless we have a tradition from back, going as far back as we can, that we can eat it, we don't eat it. I know some people that don't eat turkey for that reason, because in their families they didn't have it. But most of us do eat turkey as a kosher bird. Yeah?
Can you name a few birds that we are allowed to eat?
doves, chickens,
yep.
geese,
yep.
quail.
Yep.
Yeah. I don't need many other birds. I don't even need all of those. I don't even. I remember one wedding. I didn't attend, but I remember ducks. I remember once I came back from I came back from yeshiva once, and I had a neighbor who said they were just at a wedding, and there were 700 people, and each one got their own dove. It was a peaceful wedding. I don't know, maybe they served 700 bars of soap. I don't know.
What about pigeons?
I think that pigeons are kosher. I don't know if you would eat them off the streets of New York. And I don't. and I don't also don't know if there are different varieties of pigeons. I don't know, but I think they're kosher. I think so. But the Torah mentions a bunch of birds that, as Mari pointed out, are not kosher and some that are. But I don't know. You can find in the article the translation of some of them. But there's actually a society in Eretz Yisrael that's trying to bring back the traditions of some of the lost birds. They're going to different. They found from different communities as people came to Israel. They had a tradition in such and such community that this was kosher and we can rely on them. And there's and every like once a year they have a party where they have all these. I don't want to say strange. That's strange to us of birds or animals to eat that we didn't know were kosher, right? That they eat. Okay, so the rabbit. So what is the signs for a kosher animal? Not a bird, an animal.
Split hooves and
short skirts. So the hood has to be totally split. Has to be right. Has to be totally split, not just. Parshas when chooses cuts means literally it has four stomachs and it goes down and comes up and goes down and it's amazing. I've read about it. What happens each time it comes up is another process in the digestion that helps with the digestion and it helps with the nutrients and so on and so forth. It's an amazing thing. Those are kosher and those are the kosher animals. But the Rambam says over here that it's a mitzvah to know what the signs are. And the Sefer HaChinuch, the book of mitzvah education, which is also a very old book, writes the overall law, and someone who violates this, v'lo badak, and didn't check, but rather he saw one simon. So let's say he saw split hooves. Right? He saw split hooves, and he knows it's not a pig, because a pig is the only animal, the pig and its family, are the only animals that have split hooves that don't chew its cud. The Torah tells us that. So let's say he sees it as split hooves, but he didn't check, even though he found out afterwards. He didn't know what this animal was. He sees that it has split hooves. He says, oh, it must be kosher, right? He says he violated this positive commandment because he didn't check to see if it chews its cud, which is something that you can tell by watching the animal. Now, when you go to the deli or King Supers or a kosher thing and you see the package, it's hard to tell if it has split hooves. They don't sell you the hooves anymore, right? So you're relying on. I was thinking to myself, this is made up. And then, but how would we fulfill the mitzvah? How would we fulfill? So I'm not saying that we should do this, but in my mind I'm saying, you know what? When you go and you buy a candy bar or you buy bread or you buy something else and you see that it has a hechsher on it, you see that? Look at the ingredients and say, oh, those are all kosher ingredients. So now I've made the distinction between kosher ingredients and non-kosher ingredients, right? I've distinguished that they're all kosher. I know it's not quite the same, and I'm telling you that I just made this up. I didn't, but it's, what's the idea over here? Why? What's the big deal?
What's the question?
The question is, if the Sefer HaChinuch says that if somebody saw an animal, he didn't know what it was, and he went and checked, but he saw that it had split hooves. So he figured that it's kosher, but he didn't check on the other simon. He didn't check to see if it chews its cuds. And even if it turned out later that it was kosher, so he ate kosher, but he violated the commandment of being able to distinguish between that which is permissible and that which is not permissible.
No havdalah.
There was no havdalah. He didn't make the distinction. Because the Rambam says over here that the mitzvah is to know the simonim, to know the signs, and to be able to distinguish between them. So this is a fascinating thing. Bitel asezeh, he violated, or he didn't violate, he negated this positive commandment. When you don't do a mitzvah that you're supposed to do, you didn't violate it. You negated it. You didn't do it. That's different than violating something that you weren't supposed to do, and you did. So you don't eat this, and you ate it. So then you violated it, right? But if you were supposed to put on tefillin, then you didn't violate it. You just negated it, right? So the Rambam says over here, he negated this, the Sefer HaChinuch says that the Rambam writes, he negated this mitzvah of checking the simonim, of checking the signs. Why is it necessary? Why is this concept of distinction so necessary?
It's what sets us apart from the other nations, that we're following a path that's set down from Sinai. And in order to keep us on that path, we have to follow these cooking laws, sometimes if we don't understand them.
That's correct. That's 100% correct. But why is it so important when it comes, let's say, to checking an animal? There's something over here that the Torah is telling us numerous times, twice in this parsha that I just read to you, but even more than that, there's something about learning about Havdalah. I saw something fascinating here, and I think it is, when I said this, it was throwing cold water in my face into what's going on in today's world. And I don't only mean 2019, I mean during our lifetimes. And it's like this throughout history, but so much so in our lifetimes. I don't know if you're aware, but over the last few years, there has been a tremendous movement on the far left in the Jewish world to remove any distinctions between Jews and non-Jews. I don't know if you're aware of that, to the point where, it was last year, in 2018, in the Hebrew Union College, which is the Reform Movement's seminary, at their graduation program, this fellow, I think his name is Chubb, I'm not sure, maybe I'm mixing it up with the Broncos linebacker, but I think that was his name. He got up and he spoke, and he spoke about universalism, which is a movement that's out there today, that everybody is the same. Their idea is to eradicate any distinctions between Jews and non-Jews. So I don't know, in his place, why he has a platform on the Jewish agenda. Because if it's all the same, so what's different or what's unique about being Jews?
The one that said intermarriage is not such a problem.
Right, that was part of his thing, right. Right, that was part of his thing.
Well, I think there's a big movement towards postmodernist philosophy. And postmodernist philosophy is kind of the natural philosophy. Everything is the same. There's no distinction.
Right.
There's no gender distinctions.
Exactly.
And whatnot. So I think in regards to Torah, what's happened, what the problem is that the commandment to have Havdalah, to make distinctions, that's recognizing that Hashem has created the world that's got a system and an order to it. That's his creation, and if you recognize that, you can't say that everything is the same. You can't break down these barriers. So the postmodernism goes along with atheism as well too.
Yeah, and I think that's a lot. That's not what this book is about, but that's what's going to come out as a result of learning many of the things in this book. Yeah, but there's something here. I have to tell you, there's a quote here from Rav Kook. I don't know, he was the first chief rabbi of Israel. One of the great scholars who came out of the Volozhin Yeshiva that I mentioned before. He's very, very difficult to translate. So he really is very difficult to translate. But he says that all the different opinions, all the opposites that are found in opinions, and all the different areas that sometimes look like they're the same, he says, the more we look deeply into each thing, you're able to find that at their root, they're very, very different. And those differences actually serve as the area of nurturing for those ideas and for those thoughts. The fact that something is different and the fact that something has its own place in the world, whether in action, whether in thought, whether in philosophy, whether in something else, the fact that it's unique, that it has its own specialness, allows it to grow and allows it to become fulfilled, and allows it also to be recognized what it is. Once things become the same, then he has what's called a tishtush. Tishtush in Hebrew means a total confusion, a mix-up of everything, where everything seems the same and there's no distinction. So he says the actual unity, this is a fascinating idea that Rav Kook writes, the actual unity of things coming together, of working together, actually comes from distinction, from separating each thing so that each flower on its own can grow on its own. So he says if you take a bunch of seeds and you throw them into the ground together, so then you don't have much of a garden. It probably won't grow properly. Each one is not going to have the nourishment that it needs, and you're not going to get each one's unique, distinct things, distinct fruit that it's supposed to have. But if you put the seeds for this over here, and you put the seeds for this over here, and you put the seeds for this over here, and you plant them all in the garden, then when it grows, you're going to have beautiful apples, and you're going to have beautiful oranges, and you're going to have beautiful this, and you're going to have beautiful flowers. The fact that they're separate allows the whole thing together to produce a very harmonious, beautiful garden. When you have differences of opinion, right, to come together and say, let's throw all the opinions together, we're all the same, we all have to think the same. When you have a difference in philosophy, and I'm going to throw out something that's just on my heart, that in the last 50, 60 years, so many things have come out in the world that have been so antithetical to what I believe to be Jewish and Torah values. Many Jews have bought into them. But when they first come out, they seem good. And we grab onto it. But the problem is that we're unable to distinguish where it belongs. I'm going to throw out something, and I can't go into detail. We'll have to either work out the details ourselves, or just think about it and see how it works. But let's say the idea, for instance, in women's rights. Okay, the idea of women's rights, I don't know that this is really where it started, but it was where women should have the right to vote, right? In the early 20th century. Is that correct, early 20th century? That women should have a right to vote. Now, maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong. To me, that seems like an appropriate thing. They're citizens of the country, right? This is a democracy. In a democracy, you should have a right. They should have a say and a right to vote as much as somebody else. Now we are 100 years later, after that right was given. And I don't know for sure that that was the seed, but let's assume for the purpose of this discussion that that was the seed, or there may have been many other seeds for it, of women being the same as men. That sameness now has gone into every area of society, where if you want to distinguish between men and women, you have a phobia. Right? And there's, if you want to say that there's a difference between men and women, you have a phobia. What is that? Everything is thrown into the same pot. There's no Havdalah. There's no distinction. Right? Does the idea itself have a good root? Yes, but you have to know where and when and how to apply that root. When is it appropriate? When is it not appropriate? Just this morning, I was shocked. I got an email from somebody who was going to enroll their kid in JCC camp. And I don't have my phone on me, so I can't read it to you. But they have a new thing now. What gender are they? What gender do they identify? We honor all genders and transgenderism and things like that. And this is what the JCC is now standing for. The JCC is now standing for when parents send their little kids to JCC, they have to expose them to this. Right? So in the name of equality, it doesn't matter what it does to society. It doesn't matter what it does to the family. In the name of rights, everything else has to fall by the wayside. Right? And this is the problem when you don't have distinction. This is the problem when you don't have Abdullah. So when you have no Abdullah, everything is the same. So then you can't come to unity, because what's going to happen is the two groups are going to be so far apart. If there was some kind of Havdalah, if there was some kind of ability to be able to distinguish and to know it's appropriate here and it's not appropriate here and it's appropriate here and appropriate here, this is where the idea belongs, then perhaps you can have a meeting of the minds somewhere in the middle. But if everything falls into this pot, which is the way our society goes. We fall into things, and then you hang on to something, and it's hard to let go. The altar of Kelm, who we've discussed numerous times recently when we were discussing Musar, used to say, if you're not willing to hear another side of the opinion, at least to listen, like, why bother having a discussion? Because it's only going to lead to what we see in our society today, which is why I love this Clean Speech Colorado. And if you haven't signed up for it, you should. CleanSpeechColorado.org to get a daily dose of inspiration on clean speech. It's a great, great initiative that's going on. Right. So that was one thing over here. So it says, continues Rav Kook, in order to attain unity between different opinions, you first have to be able to distinguish between them, to put parameters where each opinion is, what's special about it, how is it different than other opinions. And then, once we've distinguished that, we can talk about how to bring them together without making the total confusion of all the different opinions in one, which you come out without any clarity at all. He says you can't grow a garden with a beautiful and nice form unless each plant and each flower and each fruit tree and each vegetable is planted in its own place. And when you have that, then you can have a beautiful garden. And he says, it's like this. This is the way that Hashem taught us in all holy things. Separation for the purpose of attachment, for the purpose of coming together, as opposed to the concept that the world has of crass unity. I don't know how to even translate it. Just, yeah, we use fancy words. I love everybody. I love the whole world. How many times have you heard me say, if you say you love the whole world, you don't love anybody. Do you love your mother-in-law? Do you love your next-door neighbor? Do you love the person who bothers you next door? Do you still care about them? Yeah. I love the person in India who I never met and I never will meet. Yeah, that's very, very nice. It's irrelevant. He says that crass unity, which speaks great and says put everything together in one package, he says it takes away all spirituality and all sensitivity from everything holy. And it takes away all clarity of mind and of thinking. And just saying that I love everybody and having open love, he says, brings more contamination to the world and brings more lack of love, of what love really is supposed to be. He says, the other side, what we call, again, he's writing in difficult terms to translate. He says, the other side, the dark side, strengthens itself through what we call unity and everything coming together. And the holy side actually becomes strengthened through separation that brings about unity. By distinction, that brings about unity. The ideas are actually very, very fascinating. And he says, that's what the Torah focuses over here. L'havdil ben ha-kodesh u'menachol. That's what the Torah is focusing over here, to be able to distinguish between that which is holy and unholy, and to distinguish between that is pure and which is contaminated. This concept of distinction is vital to us. If we just look at any issue that's out there, and we just throw it onto a bandwagon on something that we've already believed in, then we're not doing ourselves justice and we're not doing the world justice. You have to use your mind. God gave you a mind. And then you have to know the parameters about how I think about it. We have a tendency, I think all of us, to some extent, to just throw everything into one basket. This is what I believe in. Everything belongs in that basket. And that's why Havdalah is so important. The moment Shabbos is over, is Shabbos just different because we don't do certain work? Or is there a difference in the essence of Shabbos, that I'm supposed to be doing things and thinking things and relating to God on Shabbos differently than I do during the week? What's the whole concept of Havdalah? What is darkness and light? Is it just a physical difference? Is it related maybe to spiritual darkness, spiritual light? What's the difference between a Jew and a Gentile? Ben Yisrael la'amim. We shouldn't be embarrassed by that. It's not universalism. God chose us from amongst the people for a reason, for a purpose. And we're different. And that difference is not supposed to be clouded over. There's a purpose and a goal in that difference. That's how God created the world. And to think that everything is the same is a terrible mistake. So we'll continue with this. I know I only got through the first. We'll probably spend 1 or 2 weeks just doing the introduction, and then we'll get to the first part of the book, which speaks about God himself and how he's different.